This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Despite its recent notoriety, Zika's not a new virus that just materialized in the Brazilian jungle and is barreling north. In fact, it was first detected nearly 70 years ago in the Ugandan forest of Zika. It went largely unnoticed in parts of Africa and Asia for decades, likely because its symptoms aren't nearly as serious as those of diseases like dengue and malaria, and because the populations where it circulated had developed immunity. But in 2007, Zika began to register on the global health agenda when it jumped to the Pacific island of Yap and infected most of its people. Nikos Vasilakis, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Texas, says that from there, those mosquitoes covered a lot of ground.
Basically, the virus island hopped to reach French Polynesia, and from there it reached Easter Island, which belongs to Chile. And from there, we believe it made it to Brazil during the World Cup. You know, there is a robust traffic between the islands, and daily there are several boat rides. So viremic individuals, when they get on the boat and they go to the next island, there are plenty of mosquitoes that may be feeding on them and become infected. When they take another blood meal, they may transmit the virus to a new individual, and so the cycle continues.
Now, human-to-human transmission. What do we know?
Well, what we do know so far is that the virus is present in the semen, and we do have a few documented cases that the virus has been transmitted by sexual intercourse to another human being. The question mark that we don't know is how long the virus remains in the semen.
What do we know about the link between Zika and microcephaly?
Right. There are several direct and indirect lines of evidence. So, for example, let's start with the indirect line of evidence. We do know that on an average year in Brazil, there are about 140 to 150 microcephaly cases. Now, congruent with the introduction of Zika in the area, there was a 30-fold increase in the cases of microcephaly to about 3,700. That was in 2015. That number has increased upwards in the few months of 2016 to about 4,300 to 4,400. So this is an indirect line of evidence. In terms of direct lines of evidence, we do know the genetic signature of the virus was detected from a handful of fetuses that were aborted or they were delivered stillborn or they died soon thereafter. So we do know that the virus is infecting
The fetuses.
Exactly.
So the one thing you still can't say for sure is whether it's causing microcephaly.
That is correct.
How many pregnant women do you need to follow, and how long do you need to do it before you can make a definitive link?
You would need to do long-term case control studies. Definitely, you need a few thousand pregnant women, and this type of studies, they may take a few years.
Could you put Zika in context with malaria and dengue and chikungunya?
Well, remember, only a very small minority of the symptomatic cases in a very high-risk group, and that is pregnant women, may show the effects of microcephaly. That doesn't mean that any woman that is pregnant and is infected may deliver a baby with microcephaly. What we tend to forget is that about 70 to 80% of individuals infected with the Zika virus, they are completely asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
That means they may carry the virus, but they do not have any symptoms or they don't know about it. Look, the same thing can argue about West Nile or chikungunya. So, for example, when in 1999, West Nile came into the United States, it took about 2 to 3 years to spread throughout. And there were a couple of large epidemics for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then once the immunity was established, then you would see the virus completely disappear, lurk in the background. Once the immunity was reduced again, it started producing epidemics. It basically follows a bell curve. Introduction, rapid expansion, establishment of herd immunity, then gradual decrease in the cases, and then disappearing.
And then reemerging when the immunity is reduced.
Exactly.
Well, I know that you are concerned about sustaining an effort to keep the bugs down. You were talking about an example of an effort to eradicate this very mosquito in the Americas back in the 30s.
The eradication of Aedes aegypti from Latin America back in the 30s was a Herculean task, going house to house, removing containers or breeding grounds from the houses. If there was no compliance by the individuals, then they were getting fined or even going to jail. That lasted for a few years. The mosquito was completely eradicated. But the public servants, once they realized that the mosquito has been eradicated and it was not present for a number of years, they posed the question, well, we don't have it around. Why we should still pour money into it? Well, there were a few countries not compliant, and Aedes aegypti was still circulating. It took about 10 to 15 years to recolonize the entire continent.
Recolonize the mosquito.
The mosquito. And with the recolonization of mosquito, dengue reappeared in Latin America and a few other infectious diseases. Now, I may say also that effort in eliminating the mosquito, it also came with a severe price. The agent that was used to eliminate the mosquito was DDT. And of course, we all know the severe ecologic effects that it had in the food chain during that period of time. So it's not as simple as one may think.
You've noted that one of the major problems that may have contributed to the rise of Zika is that there haven't been funds for surveillance, essentially general monitoring. Frustrating that those resources only seem to follow global outcry. I mean, the National Institutes of Health has never funded a grant for Zika research before this month.
Well, it's part of the game. You know, just to paraphrase Tip O'Neill, the old Speaker of the House, saying that all politics are local. Same thing is all research is local. And one of the questions that I got through the years is, why do you think it's worth spending public dollars on this if it's not a problem from the United States? Well, the answer is we have seen it. We have seen it with dengue. We have seen it with chikungunya. We have seen it with West Nile. And now we're seeing it with Zika. Just because a virus may not be now an issue for the citizenry of the United States, that doesn't mean that it will not be a problem in the future.
Now, you were actually in Brazil examining this link between Zika and microcephaly before this recent outburst of coverage. That's how you spent your Christmas. What did you see?
Well, it was really a heartbreaking experience. And what it struck me the most was that as I was observing the parents coming in the hospital, and they had covered the babies completely so they were not visible, as they came to the waiting area and they realized that there were another 40 or 50 people with their babies that they had the exact same predicament, you would see that they started taking off the covers and they were talking to each other and they were caring for their baby, you know, showing signs of affection and so forth. And you could see that tragedy. I mean, you look at the kids, the babies, and it would break your heart. And then you would see the parents, some of them in complete denial, or some others, you know, showing this unfettered love that it would take even the strongest man not to cry.
Nikos, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nikos Vasilakis is an associate professor in the Department of Pathology and a member of the Center for Biodefense and Emerging Infectious Diseases at the University of Texas Medical Branch.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.